Welcome to Radio Free Space. My name is Michael Beezer, producer for Kirsten Liedberg, interviewing Dwight Zitlow.
Thank you so much. And Dwight, thank you for joining me today. I'm excited to be here. A few weeks ago when Dwight was visiting, he came at our dinner table for Word Wednesday. And it's when all of our kids come together with a word to share. And his word was romance. And so he said that that was kind of his life philosophy, how he looks at the world and taking the time to kind of smell the flowers and enjoy life. And so I thought that was a pretty fantastic philosophy, and I asked him to join me for this interview.
And here I am.
Yeah. So thanks again, Dwight, for being here. And can you tell us a little bit more about your definition of romance and what you mean by that?
All right. So I look at romance not so much as two people getting together and romancing in that aspect, but more like everything that happens throughout your life. Like, let's take a pretty easy one. For example, if you want to go from one destination to another, like if we wanted to leave here in Viroqua and go to where you live in Chicagoland, you can take 90 and get on a four-lane highway and get it done. And you can also go down the river road along the Mississippi and then cruise over through Galena, which is a very historic place, and travel through a lot of the hills and the valleys of the Driftless area and see sights that you've never seen before. And have more character, that is more romantic than jumping on a superhighway and going just fat crazy to get there.
Getting to the destination, enjoying the journey.
Enjoying the journey.
Yeah. So one of the things that I like about you is that you forage for foods, and so you're always aware of what's blooming, what's growing, different plants in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's time to pick them and then going out and actually foraging for different blossoms and then using them to make honeys and maple syrups and gelato, all different kinds of things with those
so
blossoms.
Yeah. So foraging for your food would be what I would call more romantic than going to a store and just buying it. And it gets less romantic when it's a prepared food. And even less romantic when you go to you might say going to a restaurant is more romantic, but in a way it's not, because you're not connected to the food really. You're connected to the environment, which is more romantic than eating at a cafeteria. But it's more romantic when you go out and you harvest the food yourself, or even raise it and tend it, and then harvest it, and then put it together into a dish it puts a lot of love into the dish, and it becomes very full of life and full of love. And then when you partake of it, you just start blossoming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so really using all your senses.
Right.
Taking the slow road.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's wonderful. And the creativity that you get to invest in whatever you're making.
Right. And then I'm considered a mad scientist of sorts. So when I start creating like that, I make things that have never been made before. And then, wow. And I share it with somebody else and they're like, wow. And pretty soon, everybody wants me to teach them how to do it. It's been kind of fun.
Dwight just brought me some ramp honey, which is an amazing finisher for any kind of particularly Asian dish.
Yeah.
So really special, really fun.
So it was, to clarify, it was ramp blossom honey. And so what I did was I infused honey with ramp blossoms. And there's a lot of people that have made garlic-infused honey. And so that's what sparked me. It's like it's an onion, so it would probably have a very nice flavor also. But when I made it, it was not a very nice flavor. It was a very wonderful flavor. I mean, just everybody that tries it just blows them away. And if you've got a dish that just needs something else, throw that in there and it's good to go. Mm.
What makes you want to use blossoms versus other parts of the plant?
Well, I guess when I started out doing sodas, I didn't really have that in mind. So I can tell you that story. When I was a teenager, and we had just moved to West Chicago, Illinois. So we entered a new church, and my parents were Methodist and very, very avid churchgoers. And so every time there was a church picnic, this one family, if they would show up, the dad of the family had this signature drink, and it was a homemade root beer. And he made it in a garbage can. And so how cool is that when you're a kid, you know, particularly when you're rebellious and you don't want to do everything normal, and that's not normal.
Right, absolutely.
So that really stuck with me in all those times. And, you know, there's romance right there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like a Coca-Cola where you pop the lid and you're drinking it. It's like, oh, this guy made this in a garbage can. How cool
wow.
is that?
Yeah.
So anyways, it was quite a few years. I was 40, geez, I don't know how old I was, 2011.
Okay.
I'm getting old, so I don't remember things as much. But anyways, I decided I wanted to make a signature drink. And I was a forager already. We're all foragers. Sometimes we just don't realize it. You know, we pick black cap raspberries, right? And sometimes, what are some of the other common ones? No, I can't even think of the common ones. But anyways, we've all foraged something at some point in our lives. And so since I was a forager, I decided my signature drink ought to be a foraged beverage. So what kind of beverages are made from foraged items? The only thing I can come up with on internet searches was elderflowers. And so that's how I started with flowers. And so 2 years into doing that, I'm picking elderflowers in the spring, and I'm like, why couldn't I do this with any flower? And I'm like, yeah, I could probably do this with any flower. And I got done picking the elderflowers, and I had to crawl underneath this barbed wire fence to get out of that pasture, and I popped up, and I'm looking directly at this quarter-acre field of Canadian thistles, and you can see the wind causing these ripples in it, and it's like waving to me, Dwight, Dwight, we want to be a soda. So it was like, okay. And then it's like, boom, something switched in my head. It's like anything that smelled wonderful, I made a soda out of from then on.
Yeah, that's pretty romantic.
Yeah.
Yeah, the plants were speaking to you.
They were speaking to me. That was like the first time. It was like clear in my head that they were speaking to me.
Yeah, and then are there other times in your life where you've seen that or smelled something or been spoken to by the plants?
Definitely by the plants. So one of the latest ones was, so there's this plant called pokeweed. Mm-hmm. The berries are pokeberries. But down south, it's more prevalent than it is around here. There's very seldom do you see a plant around here. We're kind of at the very farthest north of its
habitat.
And so down south, they have a thing called poke salad. And it's not a salad. It's a pot herb. In other words, it's an herb that is just boiled or steamed to make it palatable. And the plant is known to be very toxic, and there aren't any real cases of anybody having fatalities from it, but you can get pretty sick by eating the roots and things like that. And they even claim that, so the roots, The claim is that the roots are the most toxic, and then the berries, and then the plant itself, the vegetation. But the meristem part of the plant, which means the meristem part is the part that is actually growing. Once it's stopped growing, it's not meristem anymore. But as it's growing, you can eat it, and it will not have any adverse effects unless you have some severe allergies or something to certain plants that it might flare up. But in itself is not toxic if you boil it in water, particularly 2 changes of water. But it's super tasty like that. And so the plant said to me one year, I was visiting my brother John, who you know, lives down in Illinois also. He's got poke all over the place. It likes to grow in woods or on the edge of woods. It likes to grow where there's like a little clearing, like some trees that fell down. He had a tornado come through and knocked a bunch of trees down, so there's poke everywhere in his woods. And it was wintertime, and it had frosted already, and we were cruising around out there on a four-wheeler, and they were just like, Dwight.
We're speaking to you again.
Yeah, they're like, come here and make something out of us. We're not as toxic as they say. So I was like, okay, but I'm going to be very cautious. So I made a soda out of the pokeberry. And I've also heard cases that people in the South would take 1 to 3 berries every so often for their rheumatism.
Oh.
And so I thought, okay, so it's probably not so toxic that I couldn't take enough juice that 1 berry would have. And so I sampled, you know, just more or less got some in my mouth. And then at first I just tasted and spit it out. And I'm like, whoa, that tasted pretty good. So some time went by, in a couple hours or so, and then I took a little bit in the bottom of a shot glass, like half a teaspoonful, and survived that. And then I kept getting larger and larger doses, and by the end of a week, I was drinking a wine glass full with no ill effects. So now it's time to share it. So I shared it with my wife, Roxanne, and she had no ill effects. So then I went back down to my brother's, shared it with him and his wife, and we were drinking wine glasses right off the start. And then I visited a friend over in Elkader, Iowa, Ben Hoshk, who also is a forager. And I shared it with him and a friend that was helping him do some work on his house. And all of us lived. I'm like, whoa. Nobody got sick from any of that. So I then played around with it some more and perfected the soda, which turns into this magenta, purple magenta color that is unbelievable. And it has a really nice flavor. And I shared it with my mentor, Sam Thayer, and he's like, whoa. Because in his book, he says, you can eat the poke berries, but I wouldn't recommend them because they don't taste good.
Oh, okay.
He says they do have a toxic element in them. But, you know, they say that you can eat 2 or 3 berries. And he says, I've eaten 2 or 3 berries with no ill effect, but I don't recommend them because they're toxic. And so that's where he's left it, and he never pursued them any further. And so now I changed his mind. He like really likes pokeberry juice. With a little bit of honey in it. So that was fun. So then shortly after that was the Midwest Wild Harvest Festival, and I teach how to make sodas there, and I'm known to bring, you know, like 15 to 20 gallons of soda to share with 200 people. And I shared a 5-gallon batch of soda with 200, a pokeberry soda with 200 people and no ill effects. So So I would say that I myth busted the berries that the berries are toxic. Okay. But I would say that be careful with the seeds because I didn't use the seeds.
Okay.
I just used the juice.
Yeah. So that curiosity is what drove you.
Yeah. And so, and then the plants, you know, that they spoke to me and said, hey, we're good. Don't listen to them. Respect us, though.
Yeah. So, you know? So being open to trying those new things,
yeah.
Being curious about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things you've said to me before was a philosophy you had in raising your children was to provide them with opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah, to me, that's probably the best thing you can do with children is to give them opportunities. Anytime you shut them down, it makes it harder for them to self-start, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And children need to be the self-starters that they are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they can sometimes start things like fires that they shouldn't.
Yes.
You know, so you know, you got to take everything with a grain of salt, and you can't, like, just let them do whatever they want. You know, there's got to be some kind of guidelines, but I guess it is how you tell them to not do things is probably more important than you saying don't do that. I mean, because you have to protect them from certain things like starting fires or yeah. whatever.
Yeah. So to encourage their curiosity and then redirect them from poor choices.
Right.
Yeah. I enjoy telling my kids, hey, go out in the garden. The strawberries are blooming or the strawberries are ripe. Go eat something. Go pick something from the garden and try that, you know, straight from the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, I was helping the next door neighbors move in, and they had a moving company there helping them. And the guy that owns the moving company says he's got 6 kids. And I looked at him and said, is that all? I got 7. And Kirsten is a partner with my eldest son. And so the conversation with this gentleman then was, he says, what I do with my kids when they come over, because, you know, they're divorced, and so at mom's, they get to use all the electronics. When they come over to dad's, there's no TV and there's no electronics, and their kids are like, well, what are we going to do? He says, well, you got 40 acres out there. Why don't you go out and get lost and see what it takes to find your way back home? I thought that was fun.
That is fun, yeah. Give them an opportunity to have an adventure, yeah. Try new things, learn how to fall down.
Yeah.
So you've also shared from your childhood that your parents managed a hippie commune for a few years while you were a boy.
Yeah.
And so you had acres and acres and acres to run and play on.
Yeah, there was 80-acre organic fruit farm there, which was like heaven for a 10 to 13-year-old boy. That's when I was there for those 3 years of my life. And, man, I had so much fun. And I love fruit. And so I didn't mind picking them, but more of them got in my tummy than they got in the bucket. So we had 80 acres, and it was mostly apples. It was all organic. Quite a few pears. A grape vineyard, which was pretty good size. We had sour cherries and Bing cherries. And a few peach trees and an apricot or two. So that was just crazy fun.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah. So then there was also a big swimming pond and fishing pond, It had an island, so it was a pirate's pond and everything. Yeah, so I had so much fun down there. And there's rattlers in that part of Michigan.
Okay.
This was in Michigan, lower west Michigan, kind of along 90. Lawrence was the name of the town. 25 miles from the lake and 25 miles from Kalamazoo. We're kind of in between there. And so anyways, there's rattlesnakes out there. And so I was foraging snakes at that time. And every time I found a snake, a rattlesnake, you know, I'd have to do something with it. And generally, you know, it was common to not want them around because they're dangerous. And unlike the timber rattlers of the Driftless area along the Mississippi here, they're only in a certain locale where people don't really frequent, so they're not that big of a threat to people unless you're hiking and you're going out on the bluffs and the goat prairies and things like that. Then you got to be careful of them. And the amount of toxin in a timber rattler is way more than the little rattlesnakes that were over in Michigan, so they're just, you know, something to watch out for, no matter where you're at. But anyway, so when I would gather them, I generally would do them in, but I would also eat them, and I would save their skins, because the skins are pretty cool, and of course the rattler on the end. So I made a collection of all those every time I found one. A lot of times I just got them when they got run over from the bush hog or something like that. And then I would also forage frog lakes. We got a lot of big bullfrogs out there.
Wow.
And then fishing, of course. And I used all parts of the fish and always would use the roe on them, or the eggs. And never really made a caviar when I was that young. I didn't understand that. I just knew that I could cook them up and eat them. And
yeah.
So I did it that way. So I had a blast out there, and we had.
Yeah, sounds like a dream.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was 3 years of my life, and then, you know, teenagers can become rebellious, and then that was taken away from me. You might say we moved back to Chicagoland, and that was
that freedom and that independence and that curiosity.
Yeah. It was just really hard for me. I want to cry right now thinking about it. I just became kind of reclusive, and I guess something else coincided with that. It wasn't until I was like 30 before I discovered exactly what happened, but I was getting increasingly more angry with the world.
Okay.
And probably myself. And eventually I found out that I had mercury toxicity from the fillings in my mouth.
Mm.
And I had a lot of fillings. I inherited my mom's genes, and she had a lot of cavities. Her teeth were bad, and I got a little bit better because my dad balanced me out a little bit, and my mom lost all her teeth at 18.
Wow.
And I still had mine, but they were just full of mercury. Just crazy, a lot of mercury in there. And I finally got to the point where I couldn't even work, and just stayed at home and hibernated until at that time I was living in Cashton, Wisconsin, and I had an Amish neighbor who asked me if I would give him a taxi drive all the way to Minneapolis to a special dentist up there. And I'm like, sure, I'll do that. And I didn't even have a car.
So by helping someone out, you discovered the mercury toxicity?
I did.
Wow.
And on the way up, I was picking the Amish guy's brain about what's the symptoms that your wife is having that you're having her teeth tested the way they're testing it, which seemed really weird. They were testing it for electrical currents. I'm like, what? Electrical currents? Yeah, there's batteries are created because all the different metals that are put into your filling that in some people can receive radio stations on their teeth is the claim.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were going to test her teeth because every time she was carrying child, she would go crazy and she would want to like offer kids.
Oh my.
It was pretty serious. So anyways, I said, well, that sounds like the symptoms I got. I don't have any kids I'm trying to off, but I'm having a hard time keeping myself alive.
Yeah, so you could relate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I had my teeth tested, and we determined that it'd be beneficial for me to also get my fillings replaced. So I proceeded to do that, and immediately my life changed. I went from this recluse that couldn't work and was angry all the time to being happy, enjoying life and not worried. One of my biggest things was like, God, what is my purpose here? Help me out. I don't know what the heck I'm doing. This is painful.
Yeah, so you got your curiosity back.
So I got my curiosity back. And I was like, okay, so I'm not getting any direct answer from you, so what do I got? I got 7 kids. I'm going to be the best dad that I can be. And so I proceeded to do that. In a way, it backfired on me because my wife didn't want to go along with it.
Mm.
I'm happy the way I am. Leave me alone.
Yeah.
So that was challenging.
Yeah, so you're the dad of 7 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And you grew up, they grew up on 40 acres.
They grew up on 40 acres. Well, I got to tell you that story because that's interesting. So I was living in Chicagoland,
mm-hmm.
living in my parents' home, and they had 6. I'm number 2 of 6. And so I don't think my brother was there. He was off to college. He was a year in. You're 2 days older than me, but it was me and all my other younger siblings living in this same house, and now I got a wife and 2 kids at this point, and I'm working for a McDonald's as a maintenance man for $7 an hour, and who would even in their right mind think to go buy some property making $7 an hour? But I'm like at work one day and I'm like, I am not going to raise my kids down here. I know how bad I turned out.
Well, the land spoke to you, right?
It did.
Yeah.
And so I came up here to Wisconsin and I had a realtor all lined up and we spent a whole day looking at properties and nothing fit. I was looking for, you know, I had Mother Earth News, and you read about all this back to landers and all this kind of stuff, and you know, it's a big step, particularly if you got a young family and you're not making much money, you don't have a nest egg, you know,
mm-hmm.
how do you do that?
Right.
You know, and so people just don't. But I'm like, I'm not raising my kids here, and so I came up here looking for 2 to 10 acres that didn't have hardly any down payment and low payments, and I would homestead it. I would put buildings on it myself and all that. Just the bare land. I just got to get started, mm-hmm. you know, and couldn't find anything. I mean, there was stuff, but it was like in busy roads and too much money or, you know, something just wasn't right about it. So then the realtor said, but I have this 40-acre parcel that I don't list, but I can sell it, but I really wanted to keep it for myself.
Ooh.
But I got too much going on. I'm going to sell it to you if you're interested. So we went and looked at it, and I just So it's 40 acres, and it's like a quarter mile off from the highway, Highway 33. So, and it's a town road that goes to the middle of the property, and at the property where the road ends, there's an electric pole that you can put a meter on, and it's got an outlet there. So it's like Green Acres. They didn't have a phone up on the top, but the TV show Green Acres, for those that are younger don't know that, but check it out, Green Acres. They had an electric pole with a phone up on top of it. But we didn't have a phone, but we had electricity, and then there was a hand pump right there. And so the guy wanted 21,000 right now, 40 acres with nothing on it. It's going to go for 200,000 easy, you know. So that was quite a deal, quite a steal. And he only wanted 500 down and $300 a month. I could handle that. Mm-hmm. I scraped up 500 bucks, but now I can't live there because I couldn't find any work. It was hard to find work around here.
I can imagine.
So I had got Mother Earth News, and in the back they're always advertising for tree planters down south, Mississippi, Alabama, places like that. So I did that, and that's what got me onto my land.
Fantastic. And the serendipity and the openness.
Yeah.
And the conversations, the meeting new people.
Yeah. And all the little whispers are like, go this direction and go over here. And so then everything worked out.
Yeah, kind of the romance of enjoying the journey.
Yeah.
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 So then you raised your family there on that 40 acres?
So I raised my family there. And so it was interesting because... So my wife and I were married. We had two children. The first one was born in a hospital, and the second one was born in the hospital, and I participated in it. And then the third one, we're like, well, let's try this ourselves. It didn't look that hard. So we ended up living in a Chevy van, planting trees in Mississippi, and we started in November, and the baby was due in December, and the baby decided she wanted to come out on December 26th, and it was in a rural area in the county of Neshoba, Mississippi. The nearest town was House, Mississippi, population 12. And we were out in the suburbs planting trees. And anyway, so we delivered that child ourselves in the van. And a tornado went over the top of us about exactly the same time Neshoba was born.
Oh, my.
We named her after the county. And so that was quite an experience.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
And
a deep connection to the earth again, planting trees.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so then living in a little van with two rambunctious children and a brand new baby didn't work because there was no room, because the baby took up the big bed that we had in the back. And then the other two wanted to play and jump on the bed and fall on the baby all the time. And, you know, day-old baby, they don't need stuff like that.
Yep.
So we went out and bought a school bus.
Wow.
Mansion. Went into a mansion. Yeah, so then we were able to drive that up onto the property and plug into the electric, put a meter on it and plug into electric, and you know, we felt like we were living high on the hog.
Old school tiny houses.
Yeah. So nowadays, you know, tiny houses are the thing, and you know, school buses and vans and things like that were the beginning of tiny houses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you guys built a cabin in 2 weeks.
Yeah, so that's interesting. You know, so I was, you know, getting into my first year of planting trees. I was still able to function well in the world. But by the second year, I was angry. And then I couldn't work any. I couldn't work anymore after that season planting. I just like I can't go back to work. I just can't do it. And so I think it was that year that my best friend from high school, who went to school to be a carpenter, said, "So Dwight, I'm bringing a bunch of friends up and we're going to build a cabin for you." Because on this property was two pine tree plantations that were like 30 years old. And so they were perfect size for logs, for log cabin. And so all we needed to do is cut them down and notch them and throw them together, right? And so my friend comes up and so he brought himself and three others, and then my wife's sister's husband came, and myself. So we had six people pretty much for a week, and we threw together a cabin that was 24 by 32, two levels, in 1 week.
Those are some pretty good friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we didn't have it chinked or anything like that, but we had the structure up, and we had most of the framing up for the roof. And then the following weekend, another friend from, I think there was two friends from Illinois came up, and then some locals came, and we roofed it that weekend. And so now we're sealed off, and we can live.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. And didn't cost hardly a penny.
Yeah. And were you interested in foraging at that point in time? Or
I was.
Did that come later?
No, I was very interested. And I got very discouraged, too. So, excuse me. So I'd bought the land. I wasn't able to move up here yet. But I was able to gather construction stuff from, you know, stuff that construction sites threw away that were still good.
Okay.
You know, like 2x4s and plywood and things like that. So I gathered up a truck and a trailer full of that kind of stuff. And so I was a forager of building materials. So we brought them up. And I had a friend who was 10 years older than me, and we always called him Crazy Frank. He was a big guy and tough and kind of an ornery guy. But we got along good together. There was three of us that hung together, like the three musketeers, myself, my carpenter friend Chuck, and then Steve Bennett. And then Steve introduced us to Frank, and then Frank was an iron worker. He built iron buildings, so had a lot of building experience. And so he says, I'll come up and we'll turn all them scraps you got into a shed so you can store all your tools up there, so whenever you come up you don't have to drag them with you. And so he comes up there, and I said, guess what we're going to eat today? I says, I foraged us some milkweed pods, and I was reading, and Yule Gibbons says you can eat them. He says, I ain't eating that crap. And I says, well, why not? He says, that ain't going to taste good. I said, oh, yeah, well, Yule Gibbons eats it. And you got to put it in. Yeah, he says you have to put it in three changes of boiling water to get all the toxins out of it, to make it palatable. And so I tried that, and it really tasted bad.
Oh.
It was like totally flavorless, no texture, just this mushy, yucky stuff. And he got so mad at me because he would have made something else, but since he didn't, Now he's going to have to go hungry. I mean, he didn't have to, but, you know, it would have taken time to make more stuff. And anyways, he wasn't very happy with me, and I got so discouraged. I just stepped away from foraging for quite a few years, you know, raising a family. And there was always foraging, you know, like berries and things like that, which I know are good. So we did that, but raised a big garden and had a lot of our own food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that time to reflect and kind of come back to why you're doing something, and things don't always go as you planned, or, you know, there might be some bumps in the road.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've got to the point where I learned that never look at anything, whether it's tragic or some kind of catastrophe or, you know, just normal things that just don't go right, never look at them as being a negative. Because once you do that, then you just mope around saying, oh, why me? Poor me, you know. But if you can look at them, and a lot of times it takes some time before you look back and say, whoa, look at what happened since I did that and where I'm at now. I learned something from that, and I became a better person.
So true.
Yeah. But it's so easy to get stuck in the trap that, you know, look at what happened to me, you know, feel sorry for me because this happened. And then you never learn, you know.
Right. So taking the time to reflect, yeah, appreciate the journey.
Yeah.
Yeah. And have you gotten better at that as you've gotten older?
Oh, yeah, a lot better. Yeah. I very seldom, you know, like when you're in the heat of a catastrophe or some kind of traumatic situation, it's kind of hard to get your head around, wait a minute, what's good going to come out of this? You know, sometimes you have to just wait a few minutes or a day or so to
step back from it.
Step back from that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I got a famous story that could have been very traumatic, which I'll touch on shortly, because it takes to do it real justice, it takes 4 hours, and to do a kind of a quick version, it takes an hour, and we're gonna try to do a real quick one here in just 5-10 minutes. So a guy steals my truck and leaves me without a truck. I wasn't using it. I got two vehicles. I didn't need the truck at the time. I was just sitting in the driveway, and I was staging things because spring was coming, and I had a job where I was going to build a pond for a family, and I was just getting the truck ready for that. Anyways, a guy comes along and he steals it, and I'm like, whoa, that really messes me up. Now I don't have any of my tools because they were all in the truck. You know, I had a full set of mechanic tools, like, you know, at least $1,000 worth of tools there. I mean, nowadays they'd be worth more than that. But I had some Snap-ons and some Mac tools and things like that in there because I worked as a mechanic professionally for an implement dealership in Cashton for a while. Anyway, so my tools are all gone, and it's like, wow, what am I going to do? I can't go to a job and ask to use all their tools and expect to get paid like a professional. You know, so that was kind of bumming me out. I'll have to get paid less. Okay. Or I have to try to gather up some secondhand tools or something, you know. So that was kind of hard. Then all of a sudden, this guy's driving down the road in my truck. And he doesn't know who he stole from. And he's advertising that he is doing lawn mowing and chainsaw service on the side of the truck. So I stopped him at a stop sign, and I says, hey. He's like, what? And I walked right up to him, he thinking I'm going to want him to do some work for me. And I just kind of pointed at his chest. He's sitting in the driver's seat at a stop sign. I says, where'd you get this truck? He's like, oh no, put it in drive. And I jumped in the back.
Oh, wow.
Went on a crazy ride, and he ended up jumping out and leaving me to crash. Totaled my truck, but I come out pretty good.
You got your tools back anyway.
I got my tools, but no, actually, no. He must have sold them, because there was other tools in there, somebody else's tools.
Oh, okay.
In there. But anyways, I got beat up from the ride. I actually was unscathed from the actual last accident where it crashed. Just the way the truck tipped over, I just like walked out of it.
Amazing.
It was just crazy. Anyways, so what happened from that experience was I went from just like feeling like, well, just another person on the planet doing their grind, you know. Oh yeah, oh, kind of humdrum, you know, just okay. And all of a sudden, I'm a legend. Everybody's like, hey, Dwight! And I'm like, hi. I don't know who you are, but hi.
Wow.
And so it just was a self-esteem builder like crazy, like on steroids.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah. That one there alone was like, yeah, always look at the bad things as being good, because they are.
Yep. Yep. Instead of going through the motions, you're actually embracing life, being curious, trying to find it out.
Yeah, and so this is another interesting thing. One of my philosophies is that, you know, in that situation, I could have died. There's an element of death there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we go through different stages of life, and it's like almost every 10 years, you have to go through a rites of passage to shift into the next era of your life. Particularly like going from 13 to 16, like in there for boys, mm-hmm. maybe a little younger for girls. But for boys, particularly, they have to have that element of death. And I'd talking to a psychologist that says the exact same thing. I mean, I felt it, and he put it into words, and I'm like, wow, you're right. And so if a teenager doesn't have that element of death at some point in his teenage years, then this psychologist has noticed that they become less balanced as adults.
Hmm.
And so that's interesting.
So appreciating your own mortality.
Yeah.
So that you can embrace life.
Right.
Yeah. You can be curious. You can be on an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And here's something. I mean, you want to say to your children, no, don't do that, because you could die from that. You know, but if you think about it this way, if you think that if you're living life, how can you die?
Right.
So you go out there and you live it. And if you get hurt from it, that's not the end.
You might learn something.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you're not living, then you're not living.
Yeah, you're not living, and if you're not living, you're not contributing, you're not gaining, you're not sharing
mm-hmm.
who or what you are with the world. And so we have to live. If we become normal, then normal is kind of a flat line. It's like, think of normal, okay? So I got this good job. A 9-to-5 job, you know, and I go to work and I'm bringing home the bacon, and I, you know, after a while I'm just like, come home and I sit down in front of the TV, you know, because, oh, I deserve this. It's been a long, hard day. And the wife has food, you know, for you, you know, and then so you eat, and it's like, oh, man, I got that after eating blues, you know, and sit down and watch some more TV, you know, and pretty soon it's time to go to bed, and you get up, you do the same thing, and you do the same thing, and you do the same thing, and you're normal, you're flatlined.
You're going through the motions.
Going through the motion. It's not life.
Mm-hmm.
That's leading to a death.
Right.
But if you are out there and you don't create those kinds of habitual things that create normalcy, then you are alive. And if you're alive, how can you die? So it will stretch your life longer than if you are living a normal life.
And it's romantic, right? It's
romantic.
Yeah, yeah. Actually engaging. Mm-hmm. Yeah, taking the time to appreciate.
Yep.